Ships were the most complicated technical systems of the 18th century. And the reason they worked well was because of the combination of the very disparate elements out of which they were made. The ropes, the spars, the sails, the timbers, but above all, the humans who worked these extraordinary machines. In order to make naval efficiency, it was necessary to start treating people as though they were things, and the relations between people as though these were the relations between things. Think, for example, about the way in which the pulley blocks, which run the ropes on this ship, were made. Because made of timber, they had to be cut with saws, pit saws, which needed the labor of two strong men. And each block was therefore a matter of skilled judgment, impossible easily to coordinate or standardize. The drive right through the second half of the 18th century and well into the 19th century is as far as possible to replace errant and unreliable humans by reliable and automated machinery, to de-skill labor and bring it under managerial control. In that way, a ship like this became a symbol of the process of automating production. Dramatic economic and technical change brought with it dramatic political change, both in Britain and across the Channel in France. The revolution, which started in France in 1789, was contested by a fiercely reactionary British government in a world war which lasted for more than 20 years. British victory in the Napoleonic War, I think, owed less to the bulldog spirit and far more to technology and taxes. The extraordinarily efficient British tax system, which relied on the knowledge of the whole British economy, meant that the British government could raise vast quantities of cash, both to pay foreign armies and also to build its own war machine. And the technology which counted was naval technology. First of all, the science and technique of navigation, which let British mariners sail efficiently and rapidly across the world's oceans, and even more importantly, the standardized and efficient managerial system of the naval dockyards and the ships themselves, which meant they could be re-equipped for sea extraordinarily fast, something which mattered a great deal during the maritime war against the French. So by 1815, with British maritime supremacy established, the nation emerged as the world's greatest colonial, imperial, and economic power. The Netherlands was the economic miracle of the 17th century. The British tried to ignore it, and then defeat it, and then copy it. First of all, a series of navigation acts, which meant that the Dutch carrying trade, the way in which the Dutch boats monopolize most of the trade across the North Sea and into the Baltic, they were banned from carrying any British goods into British ports. Then in three dramatic wars in the middle of the 17th century, the British Navy eventually destroyed the Dutch fleet. Finally, after 1689, the British adopted the Dutch system, lock, stock, and barrel. A new Bank of England, a new financial arrangement, a new political settlement, and the British had beaten the Dutch at their own game. Certainly, European command over world trade routes depended on their ability to send boats into the oceans well beyond their own shores. But the system that counted was the combination of the great European ships and these huge naval guns, capable of delivering vast shock in naval warfare. From the 15th century on, European ships sailed out of the Mediterranean, away from the Atlantic coast, to cover the world's oceans. And they carried with them scores and then eventually more than 100 guns on each vessel. This was crucial. These great iron guns could be used on land, to be sure, but the difficulties of land communication, the bad roads, meant that such great guns were only really used on land in sieges. At sea, it was a completely different story. A warship with 70 or more guns was a huge military presence in a systematic campaign to establish European global dominance over world trade.